I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
Let's talk about the most brutal crime that I have covered for a while, and I cover many, many brutal crimes. Let's talk about our little girl who should be living her life freely and fully right now, but isn't because of the perpetrator in this case. Let's talk about Emily Grace Barringer. She was born 8 weeks premature on the 27th of November 2015. Now, I had a prem child. That means you're in NICU with them. And obviously, it also means that they can have some challenges to the beginning of their world. And just for a parent, it's really difficult when you give birth and then all of a sudden you're not with your child directly. They've been taken to NICU. And you have to go through the trials and challenges of that difficult time. And certainly 8 weeks premature, well, she's at a point where hopefully everything's going to be okay, because at 32 weeks, most children are fine. But it doesn't mean that you don't have a huge amount of fear about possibilities. But she overcomes those health challenges. So she is now a child that has everything to look forward to. She has a parent who loves her, she's got siblings who are going to adore her, and a life where she can thrive. Now, she's just 10 months of age when she loses a life. So all of that possibility ends because of the perpetrator in this case. Her mother, Amanda Lee Adkins, she was a young woman. She was a single mum. She was raising multiple children, which is obviously pretty challenging, but she adored her kids. And Emily had three older half-siblings. She had Cameron, who was two, Carly Page, who was six, and Nathaniel, who was seven. And there were lots of other extended family members who were involved in her household and who adored her. And everybody who spent time with her just thought she was the sweetest little angel. Apparently, she had the most gorgeous smile. She was really full of life. She was that typical happy baby girl. She was at that point where she was going to get ready to walk and then no doubt to dance, and of course to have that curiosity and inquisitiveness about the world around her. And Amanda, her mother, absolutely loved her to pieces. And I know that we can say that people post things on social media which are mythical, and they do. We all know that. What people put on Facebook, etc., is often not true, but genuinely where Amanda is concerned, it is clear that she adored that child. She had lots of pictures on Facebook of her daughter, just saying how much love she had for her. Now, after she relocates home in 2016, she ends up meeting a new guy. This guy's called Benjamin Ryan Taylor. He's 32 years of age. They begin dating in July of 2016. And I have to be real with you, when it comes down to it, people who knew him and who knew her said they really worked together as a couple. People liked him as an individual. They're very fond of him. He was actually from the Jackson County area of West Virginia. And people said, you know, we thought he was good for her. Their relationship seemed healthy, and most people felt he was an overall decent guy. He did, however, move in with Amanda after just a couple of months of them dating. Now, that worries me. This isn't about me trying to be really harsh and judgmental towards Amanda. What I'm saying is, anyone can behave well for at least 12 months, if not a few years, before you start to see their true colours. And a lot of you will relate to that. You'll have been in a relationship where the person started off being amazing, and then 6 months down the line, maybe not quite as amazing, a year down the line, you're thinking, did I get it wrong? And then you realise that you've met somebody who's either a perpetrator of domestic abuse, or they're being coercive towards you, or they're just making your self-esteem feel like it's on the floor. When we first meet people, we meet them at their best, and then slowly that best can be eroded. And so a few months into a relationship, you have no idea who this human being is. You don't know who they're going to become. And when you have children, you have to remember as well, and this is going to sound awful, because it will make you think I walk around the world just being horribly suspicious of every human being. I'm not trying to say it in that way. I appreciate we all need to trust in core most people that we spend our lives with, because fundamentally that's what relationships are based on. But what I'm telling you is, if you are a perpetrator of child abuse, for example, your job and your purpose in life is to find opportunities to get close to kids. Simple as that. So if you want, because you have a predilection towards children on a sexual level, to be around those children, you're going to need to put on this mask of acceptability that shields the monster beneath, because no mother's going to let you into the home with their kids if you're coming across as somebody who's going to be problematic around children. That's not what most mothers do. There will be a few, because there are also female perpetrators out there. For the most part, no woman would let you cross the threshold if she thought you would harm the hair on one of the heads of their children. However, child predators know that. So they form a picture of acceptability, of kindness, of compassion. They will make a single mother in particular, who maybe is vulnerable economically, feel like all her dreams are going to be answered. And so they fast forward to getting into that place and space by being super perfect. And then, of course, once they're in there, they've got their feet under the door. It means that they can then carry out the abuse that they wish to carry out. So a couple of months into a relationship is not really the best amount of time before somebody should move into your house. You should leave it longer, like I said, because of those realities. And it's horrible that you have to think like that, but I'm telling you, you do have to think like that. And bear in mind, Amanda is probably thinking this guy is going to be really good for her kids, a father figure. Maybe he's going to create opportunities that wouldn't be available in the home because economically he's okay. He worked as a construction worker for a company named Douglas Builders. But equally, I think just a scan of his social media page does bring in some concerns about him, because his Facebook cover photo read, "I will never apologize for being a sex freak." Well, with respect, at the end of this, he's probably going to have to spend the entire rest of his life apologising whilst he's in prison for being that very sex freak. Now, I get it. Some people will say, well, if you look at that, it's probably just banter. Somebody's just having a giggle saying they're a sex freak and they won't apologise for it. But how many people do you know have got those kind of taglines on their profile? It's weird. It's creepy. It says something odd about this character, and I feel it gives you an insight into his lack of boundaries around this area. Now, he does have a 5-year-old son of his own. This is a child, obviously, he had before he met Amanda. And he does have, what can I describe, a rather lengthy rap sheet when it comes down to prior criminal records. So he's got grand larceny, but with respect, just to head up, there's no documented sexual offences or violence against minors before this actual case. However, in 2003, he was charged for manufacturing a controlled substance. Now, those charges were dismissed. Doesn't mean he didn't do it. The same year, he actually pled guilty for the possession of 15 grams of marijuana and was given a $100 fine. I get it. No biggie. But it just kind of shaped up this lack of willingness to abide by rules and regulations that clearly is within his mindset. He was actually given a misdemeanor charge in 2008 because he was making obscene phone calls and he was threatening someone. Now, again, those charges were dismissed, the larger ones that were within it, because he gave a guilty plea to some lesser charges. He was also given a misdemeanor charge in 2011 for driving without a seatbelt. Again, no biggie, but again, it says that he doesn't like to abide by rules. He then pled no contest to a DUI in 2015. He was fined just over $300 and placed on a 6-month house arrest. Then in 2016, he was given another misdemeanor because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, despite the fact that had happened to him before. And during that particular stop, it was revealed that he'd been driving with a suspended license, and that was because of unpaid traffic tickets and also an active DUI investigation. I think we're forming a picture, aren't we, here? This is somebody who just doesn't think about the consequences, has poor impulse control, and really doesn't like to abide by rules and regulations that other people set for him. Also, just to add to this, he had a record of burglary and breaking probation. Seems like a dreamboat. He also had a reported heavy use of alcohol. He'd had episodes apparently of blacking out. In fact, he does speak to the investigators during this case, saying that he blacked out multiple times on the night that he carried out this horrendous crime. Though, I'm just going to tell you from now, a little bit convenient, isn't it? Just a little bit convenient. Just decides that on the night he carries out a horrendous crime that he just blacked out quite a few times. I mean, some would say that we could air that with suspicion. Now, on October the 2nd, 2016, this is the day when the worst crime possible is essentially carried out. Amanda and Benjamin had spent the day drinking and they'd been smoking marijuana. They actually had visitors over earlier in the evening, but those visitors left after a brief stay. Amanda, who by her own admission had been drinking and smoking weed, probably was knackered by 9 p.m, so she ends up going to bed. She then puts the children to bed, and Emily was in her crib in a room on the upper floor of the home. So Yes, she's stoned. Yes, she's had a few drinks. But at the end of the day, she's gone about her business as a mother, putting her children to bed, making sure they are safe and secure. Now, Benjamin, he has stayed up because he wants to do some laundry. Also, he wants to drink more beer because he likes his alcohol. Now, you think at that moment in time, put yourself in the position of being stoned and drunk. I'm just going to throw it out there. Not necessarily me thinking, I think I'll just go and do the washing. I mean, genuinely, when you're drunk and you're high, you probably want to make some toast and watch TV. But the idea that you want to do, I don't know, the laundry and the housework just doesn't compute as far as I'm concerned. And I genuinely believe this is because the predator had made a decision about what was going to play out that particular night. And for Amanda, there is absolutely no way on God's earth that she could have envisaged for even a millisecond the horror that she is going to come round to later on. Because in the early hours of October the 3rd, she goes, as you do as a mother, to check on your babies. Bear in mind, Emily's only 10 months of age. She probably hasn't woken up, and that's unusual as far as the mum is concerned, because we all know when you've got a child of 10 months, they tend to wake up a couple of times. Maybe they're hungry, they cry because they're in the dark. But she realises that she hasn't heard from Emily, so she wants to make sure that she's okay. Now, one of the things that she immediately realises when she wakes up that's a bit weird is that her boyfriend isn't in bed next to her. It's around 4:45 a.m. So she's thinking to herself, where is he? And then she goes to look at where her baby had been sleeping, and her baby isn't in the crib. So Amanda is concerned by this, but not terrified. I mean, in that moment, she thinks there's a very simple explanation. So she walks around the house. She wants to figure out where she's gone. And she's assuming at this point, of course, that potentially her little girl has fallen asleep with Benjamin downstairs. Maybe he's been doing the laundry. Maybe he's heard the baby crying. Doesn't want to disturb her, you know, being a bit chivalrous. And he's taken the baby downstairs and they're now happily cozied up on the couch. She walks around the home. She can't find a baby. She can't find Benjamin. Now, the only place that she can think to check is the basement at this point, because she's seen and looked everywhere else. She remembers, because of the fact that he said he was going to do the laundry, that that could be a reasonable explanation. He's down in the basement. He wants to be responsible, so baby's with him. What she sees when she goes into that basement is a sight that she will never, ever get over. I don't need to know this woman to know about the embedded trauma that will have occurred in the moments that I'm going to describe now. Because she's thinking, Benjamin and my baby, they'll definitely be together. He's going to be looking after her. He's a guy I've invited into my life who I trust. And there's a very simple explanation for this. And then she realizes the explanation is as far away from simple as any explanation could be. Because Emily is lying naked on a pile of laundry. The lights are dim. She can't initially make out what's going on, but she can see leaning over her beautiful 10-month-old baby was her new boyfriend, Benjamin. And she knew instantly it was sinister. He's sweating. His jeans are unbuttoned. His shirt's off. She immediately says, what are you doing? He then tells her he's drying her daughter off. She says, why would you be drying her off at this time? And then she walks closer, as you would do, because she knows it doesn't resonate, it doesn't make sense. And then out of the confusion, she realises that her beautiful 10-month-old baby girl is literally covered in blood, her face just covered. Also, she can hear her daughter is making these horrible gurgling sounds. She touches it, she's cold. At this point, Amanda just slaps Benjamin across the face. She screams at him, what did you do? Then she rushes her baby girl upstairs, away from Benjamin, because bear in mind, she knows immediately this man is a predator of the highest level in that moment. She calls 911. She must have been thinking to herself that what he's done to her daughter, he could come and also harm her too, because the gravity of his ability to do harm is just enormous. Now, in that call, she's screaming, I think he fucking raped her. She can literally be heard in the background screaming at Benjamin, what the fuck are you doing? Why is she naked? She also tells the 911 dispatcher that her daughter is bleeding from her vagina. Can imagine how the paramedics are feeling as they arrive with that information. But before they do anything else, they have to get that little girl to hospital, and they take her to Charleston Hospital. Now, unfortunately, she won't make it. After a couple of days, she is pronounced brain dead and she's removed from life support. The medical examinations that were done reveal the most horrific injuries that clearly mean that there's not been a tragic accident here. This little girl has been subjected to the most heinous, horrific abuse. But in between, you have Amanda, who's now realising that the rest of her life is going to be without her beautiful baby girl, because she has to make that horrendous decision on October the 5th, 2016, just 2 days after that horrific attack, to actually switch her beautiful little girl off. They take her off life support, and the reality of that is that she is the one who ultimately has to bear the weight of that decision. Now, she's told by the doctors that her daughter stood no chance of survival. Amanda then said to friends and put it out on social media, "It is with an extremely broken heart to announce that our sweet, innocent baby girl's fight is over. She's succumbed to her injuries. Please continue to pray for our family, for we are completely devastated." The police who came to the scene of that crime found Amanda initially just crying, holding on to a baby daughter who was obviously covered in blood. And at that point, they noted Benjamin Taylor was there. And at this point, they arrested him under charges of child abuse and sexual assault and murder of a child. He's then taken into custody. This is shortly after Emily's been transferred to Charleston Area Medical Center. And before he's arrested, police can tell it, he's acting in a really weird way. He's trying to wipe something off his groin. Now, I don't know about you, but in a situation like this, I think instantly that screams, "I'm a guilty, massive sexual predator." You know, why would you be trying to wipe anything off your groin? If you've got nothing to hide, there's nothing to wipe, right? Now, the reality is what he was trying to do is to remove Emily's blood from his groin. He also lifts his top, where he's got a blood stain on his stomach, and he says, "Look, this is where I picked her up." He's also got blood in his thigh, which is deeply incriminating because clearly he's picked her up with the stomach, but apparently his groin's going to be clear, but then he's got it on his thigh. So it's clear it's a clean-up opportunity for him, and it's going to go horribly wrong for him. But nonetheless, it shows he recognises his culpability. He knows he's responsible, and he's doing everything in his power to seem less responsible. Now, law enforcement then have to secure the actual crime scene. They then start collecting evidence, and that evidence just reveals the most tragic events that led up to this beautiful little girl's death. So first of all, the blood is everywhere, literally everywhere. It's all over the sheets, it's all over clothing in the basement area, and there's actually blood that's soaked through a rug completely. Now, when they start to question Benjamin Taylor about this, he tells law enforcement that all he remembers is taking the 10-month-old down to the basement. Just doesn't remember anything else. Said that she didn't seem ready to sleep, and then he blacked out, and then he'd lost all his memory of everything else. Says that he remembers laying her down on the carpet, that she's wearing a diaper and a onesie, but then he wakes up in the early hours on the basement floor for about 30 to 45 seconds. Then he remembers seeing the child gurgling in front of him, and then he administers CPR. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? He can remember literally nothing apart from the heroic stepping in of doing CPR. His next memory is when Amanda comes downstairs and he pulls the blanket back at that point, sees blood, and then tells Amanda, "I didn't molest her." Let's just dig into that for a minute. So just put yourself in that position. You've blacked out. You've come round. Your girlfriend's child is there gurgling. Apparently you're doing CPR. Then said girlfriend is walking down the stairs and your initial response is to say, "I didn't molest her." Said only a molester. Because I don't know, the average human being, it wouldn't even come into your mind that your girlfriend is going to think you molest her child because you're a trustworthy human being. Nobody who is innocent would ever speak the words, "I didn't molest her," in the moment when a child is bleeding, because all you'd be thinking about is, "Oh my God, what has happened to this baby?" So it's clear from the very get-go that he has done something unspeakable to this little girl. Also, one of the things that the deputies noticed is that when they arrived on the scene, And also, when he started being questioned by them, he just seemed really detached. They actually said during his questioning he was calm, and that's completely atypical for this kind of a situation. You would imagine it to be very, very heated, particularly if you're protesting your innocence. Also, he gave a lot of conflicting accounts. He didn't seem at all alarmed by the child's condition. He's not going to, is he, though? Because he caused it. As an adult, when you've caused horrific damage to a child, you know the consequences of those actions. So he's not going to ask, because he's going to damn well know it's highly unlikely this little girl has survived. Also, he's doing the classic age-old, I have no idea how the injuries occurred. I can remember that I did all the heroic things like CPR, and I can remember she was in a onesie, but I can't remember any of the brutality that followed because, you know, it wasn't me. That's basically what he's trying to push in this scenario. He just tells detectives how he's blacked out multiple times in the past, but also on this particular occasion, you know, where he really needs his memory to kick in because a child has died. Apparently, it was multiple times on that night that he blacked out. Also, he can't evidence that it's ever been a problem in his life because he's never sought medical attention for it ever, but people have just got to take him at his word. He also says that he's no memory of trying to wash blood down the sink, because as they look forensically at the crime scene, it's clear that blood has gone down the actual sink. So he's been trying to wash himself, which means he knows he's guilty. It means he knows what he's done is wrong, and he's desperately trying to hide the evidence. So this is a perpetrator who recognizes the consequences of his actions. And yes, it wasn't enough to stop him taking part in those actions, but now he's trying to hide the fact that he's been involved, meaning he knew exactly what he was doing and exactly what the repercussions would be should he be caught. Now, he does admit, and he later test positive to drinking alcohol and smoking weed. We know that anyway, because Amanda tells the police that. And he also said that on the evening when the crime played out, he consumed 8 bottles of beer between 2 p.m. and midnight. I'm sorry, between 2 p.m. and midnight, you're not going to be inebriated to a point where you're blacking out. It's as simple as that. He said he'd had about 1 hour or so since 2 p.m. That is not enough to make you black out drunk. Also, the police said he didn't come across as inebriated at all. He also said that he did go outside a couple of times on the evening and smoke weed. And he also said he used the basement door to go in and out of the house. Now, like I said, the officers really don't feel this is truthful. He's very able to answer questions and also to provide answers, albeit the answers are, well, I have no idea. I just know I didn't do it. Now, when it came down to the autopsy of Emily, it's horrific. Just strap in. It really is horrific. I don't know how else to warn you about what I'm going to speak of now. And I have a baby girl who is 1 month old, and I have a 2-year-old girl. And I don't want to even tell you the things I've imagined doing to this guy because of what he does to this little girl. I mean it. I literally want to do unspeakable things to this excuse of a human. I really do. There is not enough punishment in this world that I could actually impart towards this individual, because he is deserving of just brutality forever, as far as I'm concerned. That autopsy showed that she had multiple injuries consistent with being vaginally penetrated multiple times by an adult male. A 10-month-old baby girl, think about the damage. Think about a male sexually penetrating her multiple times and the trauma that's going to create internally. Then there's blunt force trauma to her head, fractures to her skull. That was actually her official cause of death. She had brain hemorrhaging. She had blunt force trauma to the chest, to the neck, to the abdomen, to the buttocks, to the pelvis and her extremities. She had deep scalp hemorrhages. And those deep scalp hemorrhages, that suggests she's been forcefully thrown against the ground or slammed against an object. Let that sink in. If the sexual brutality, perversion and deviance is not difficult enough to get our heads around, this man either threw her against the ground or slammed her against an object. Also, there was evidence of smothering. There were marks consistent with her large male body applying pressure on her torso, her face and her neck while she was placed in the missionary position. She had a perineal tear, which is a laceration or a tear of the perineum. So that's the area of skin and tissue between the vaginal opening and the anus. Usually you'll know that particular term through childbirth. That can happen. She also had an anal tear. And they actually said that those injuries were likely caused hours before she was found by her mother. So this abuse went on for hours. It is absolutely horrifying to imagine the agony that child endured. Now, when it came down to him being interviewed, he was then charged and he was held without bond in South Central Regional Jail in Charleston. Rightfully so. Benjamin Taylor should not walk the streets ever again, obviously, but he's certainly one of those individuals we know doesn't follow protocol when it comes down to rules and regulations. He's violated probation. So even if he were allowed to be set free until his trial, the reality is he's probably going to be a flight risk. And also with these kind of serious charges, it means he's a risk to any other child around him. Now, the charges initially are first degree sexual assault, but he's then charged 2 days after with first degree murder because, unfortunately, as we know, Emily died. And he was officially indicted for the charges on the 26th of October 2016. By the 10th of December, the judge had found probable cause for first degree murder and first degree sexual assault, and rightly so, goes without saying. Now, on December the 5th, 2016, an interesting petition was made. I would have signed it. I would imagine that when I tell you what it was for, you guys would sign it. Because this petition was demanding for Benjamin Taylor to be publicly hanged. They actually sent that to the government. Honestly, guys, I didn't actually create that particular petition, but I certainly feel that that petition is one I could have created. And like I said, I would have signed it. In fact, I would have signed it from all of my family members in different signatures, just to give some gravity and license to that reality of what we wish to happen. I know, I get it, guys, I get it. The death sentence ultimately can lead to people who are innocent being killed, and that is a travesty and should be avoided at all costs. But then there are those that are indisputably guilty and have done the most horrific crimes. And I'm like, this guy should not be paid for by public taxes to survive for however long he gets in prison. This guy does not deserve the life that he's been blessed with, no matter whether he's in prison or otherwise. He, as far as I am concerned, has absolutely been deserving of that life being removed. You won't be surprised it had loads of signatures. Now, Benjamin's trial actually got postponed. It went ahead in 2019, and he actually had to appear in court wearing a bulletproof vest and a helmet. I think we can imagine why that was the case, because the sentiments in the community were that he did not deserve the life that he was living, no matter where he was living that life. Now, because of the nature of this case, there were 7 law enforcement agencies present at the courtroom. These included Ravenwood Police, Ripley Police, Jackson County Sheriff's Office, West Virginia State Police, WVDNR, the US Marshal's Office, and also the Fire Marshal's Office. Now, because this case involves such graphic and really emotionally distressing information, early court hearings were actually closed to the public. The prosecutors actually argued that Taylor's actions were not only intentional, but also that they displayed extreme cruelty. I mean, if these weren't intentional or weren't extremely cruel, what would that mean about crime? I mean, this has got to be the worst of the worst, hasn't it? So the prosecution is absolutely right. There was a level of premeditation without a doubt as far as I'm concerned in this crime. I definitely think he was harboring these malevolent and deviant interests in children, and he probably had acted out in other circumstances. But there was something about this particular evening where every desire, every depraved fantasy just bubbled over, and he gave himself a permission base to carry out the most horrific crime. So without a doubt, extremely cruel. Remember, he probably slammed her on the floor or against a wall. He raped her repeatedly, and he did this all the while knowing the kind of damage that that would actually create for a 10-month-old baby. So cruel beyond measure. Now, the state announced it would seek life in prison without the possibility of parole. The reason it didn't go for the death sentence is the state does not have the death sentence, so it wasn't on the table. And what did Benjamin Taylor do? He pled not guilty. He literally pled not guilty. And it is laughable, but in the most grotesque of ways, because we're talking about a 10-month-old baby being raped and murdered. And this guy thinks there's a possible chance he's going to walk? What planet is he on? That's what we have to ask ourselves. Well, planet, I've done nothing wrong. Planet, my boundaries show that I can live like this, act like this, kill like this, get away with it like this, and just carry on my merry way because I don't have any morals or ethics about my body. Because the truth is that child abusers, they genuinely feel they have a right to do what they do. Child sexual abuse perpetrators believe that their inclinations are normal and therefore they don't operate in the line of conscience that you or I do. So for him, why should he go to prison? At the end of the day, he just killed a child after molesting her horrifically. Hey, no big deal. Now, his defense attorney did what we'd expect them to do. They requested psychiatric evaluations because they wanted to see if there was anything going on, you know, at a deeper level that could have led to these actions. And I think we can all agree there is. He's a massive narcissistic psychopath. But aside from that, they also wanted to see if there was any mental health issues, as if that would contribute to killing a baby. But what they were trying to argue was that Benjamin Taylor, I kid you not, guys, was under emotional stress. Yes, emotional stress. That's the bar for murdering a baby after doing unspeakable sexual things to them. Emotional stress. If that were the bar for killing people, no one would be alive. No one. My entire family would have been massacred by me. Because you know what? We all go through a bit of emotional stress, don't we? Happens to me on a regular basis. Got lots of kids, lots of responsibilities. There are moments where I'm a little bit on the stress side. I don't kill my kids because of that. And I don't kill other people's kids because of that. And I'm not sure where the defense was going, but I'm imagining they're thinking to themselves, we literally have no defense. There's no defense. I mean, the guy went not guilty. It was left field. We didn't think he was going to think that that was a possibility. And now we're left to defend him. That's why we're public defenders. And so we've got nothing to actually defend. We'll just go for the, well, he was stressed card. I can only imagine that was why. Although you'll shortly hear they do something else that defies logic and reason too. Now, the court appointed mental health professionals to also interview this particular perpetrator. And they, unfortunately for the defense, said, yeah, he's okay. He's fine. He's fit to stand trial. Now, one of the most impactful testimonies during that trial came from Amanda, the mother in this case. She actually described the morning that she discovered her beautiful little girl lying completely unresponsive in the basement with that adult male over her. Amanda talked about the 911 call, just trying desperately to keep Emily conscious as the paramedics were en route, just trying to save her daughter's life. She also testified about Benjamin Taylor's behaviour that morning. She said that he lacked urgency and he was just really emotionally detached. She said in court, he said he didn't know what happened, but she was in his care. Now, the medical examiner, they testified in absolute detail about the injuries that had led to Emily's death. They explained that her brain had suffered irreversible damage because of blunt force trauma. And also the investigations showed that that same night he had raped Emily. Now, bear in mind, they also were able to digitally analyse his data and they found that he'd been watching pornography at around 2:15 a.m. He was also listening to music on his phone, so he was gearing himself up for this. Now, he did acknowledge that he'd used his phone to view pornography and that was just a little more than an hour before his girlfriend found him with Emily. Now, further phone evidence, it showed that while investigators were actually at his apartment, this is before his arrest, his brother had texted him to actually ask what had happened. Now, his brother had texted him because he'd made a call to a contact named Home. It was around 4:54 a.m. That's 6 minutes before the response team arrived. Now, he replied to his brother and texted back saying, dumb shit, but don't worry, I'll be dead sometime. Well, yes, if that petition was accepted by the government, you would be. In the public square, probably with women knitting like they did in the French Revolution where people were being guillotined. Anyway, that's just me going into a fantasy zone right there as to what I wish could happen in this situation. But also it does expose the fact that this guy knows what he's done and knows there are going to be serious consequences. Now, the prosecutors, they were actually able to use the body cam footage in court, which shows him pulling the waistband of his pants down, which firstly exposes his genitals to the police. I mean, That just seems like a little bit of a weird thing to do anyway, but apparently he's trying to show the police that there's no blood on his penis. Like, literally. Now, the fact that he has bloodstains in that footage on his leg and torso, which is massively incriminating, demonstrates that he hadn't really thought it through. But the fact that he needs to show the police his penis in this way, again, it screams guilt. You wouldn't even think about that, not for a second. If you have not abused a child sexually, you're not going to be thinking that you have to prove anything to the authorities, because truth is truth. Now, the prosecutor said to Taylor's defense team, "Without a doubt in my mind, your client is responsible for the rape and murder of Emily Barringer." They went on to say that he'd actually locked the window of the basement and the door of the house, because clearly that makes it more difficult for first responders to get in. And also the forensic evidence of the blood stains on the laundry, on his clothes, as well as the blood that was found on the floor of the basement, as well as the blood that was found soaked through the rug on the floor. I mean, we're talking about a 10-month-old baby. They don't have a lot of blood compared to an adult, and it's everywhere. And there was also that blood in the sink where he tried to wash the incriminating evidence away, which means that he was trying to conceal evidence because he knows damn straight that he is guilty as hell. Now, the court also played his calls from jail, and they are breathtaking in nature. One of the calls is on the phone to his mother. Now, I don't know about you, most crimes I think I would be able to visit my children in prison for. Even if they were serving a full life tariff, I would usually be the person who would see that I could go and be with my child because I love them in spite of their actions. I have to say, child rape and murder, I ain't seeing you again, kid. You ain't somebody I want to be involved with. I don't care how much I've loved you in the past, you've become a monster. So I would not be calling you, you would not be calling me, you would be dead to me. Out of respect for the baby or the child that you'd harmed. Now, on one of these calls, he's speaking to his mother and he says, "I'm so sorry, I didn't molest that child. I did do something bad, but I didn't molest her. I'm not afraid to take my punishment for what I've done, but what I've been charged with isn't what I should be charged with." Bizarre, because the reality is, again, methinks he doth protest too much, and he does. Why is he bothered about the molestation part? You know, he's clearly murdered the baby. He's not saying he didn't do that. But the molesting part, well, let's be clear. When you're in prison, it ain't going to look good for you if you're going to prison for raping and murdering a baby. I mean, when we talk about lowest of the lowest of the low, he's literally below all of that. In fact, he's just about 10 feet away from hell, where he'll be spending eternity after he dies. And dying, well, it might come a bit more quickly in a prison surrounded by big, beefy guys who don't like child killers and rapists. So not being known for molestation is important for him because firstly, he obviously feels that that's really bad and that people think it's really bad, and they do, which also psychologically means he fully understands that what he was doing was absolutely wrong because he recognises that morality that most of us have. And also the fact that he's telling his mother this and that she's hearing it and not responding with some kind of retaliation where she tells him that he's got to take accountability because he's a complete wrong-un. And that makes me think, how to raise a narcissist? They then play another call with him and his mother. Again, he shows no remorse whatsoever, but I have deep concerns about his mother as well. Because in this call, they're talking about how the organs of Emily have been donated, because clearly Emily's mother, in spite of her agony, in spite of her loss, in spite of her grief, in those moments where she had to choose to turn her child's life support off, she makes that incredibly selfless decision to donate her baby girl's organs so that other children can survive. Now, his mother says, again, wait for it, "I'm glad something good will come of this." Oh, are you? "Yes, I'm glad that something good will come of this." What good? "Some other children will live because Emily has died." I think Emily didn't die. Emily was raped and murdered by your bastard son who you brought up. And your response to this is, well, something good. Silver linings coming out of it. Honestly, I don't like what she says in this phone call. There's nothing good coming out of this. I appreciate that hopefully other children will have better lives because of Emily's killing. But can we not say good? This is horrendous. It's the worst of the worst. And the idea that anyone can find a silver lining in that moment is bizarre. Benjamin then responds to his mother, "The reason why I think that's a good thing is because they don't have much evidence. Can somebody please go in to the jail where he is with, I don't know, a human-sized liquidizer? Ask him to get in and then wait for me to come and turn on the button." Seriously, what is going on with this man that he feels that the organs that they've donated, they're going to prevent him potentially from being in court and being found guilty because, you know, they don't have much evidence. Now, I think you'll find they have so much evidence and the internal organs are not required for that. Now, bear in mind, in court, they bring in the forensic scientists who cover the case and they bring in the pictures that show little Emily's diaper that's got blood in. Also, they bring in semen evidence. And they also did state to the court how seminal fluid had been found on the jeans that he was wearing at the time. So clearly, bang to rights, dead to rights. Also, they bring into court what was on that Facebook page, the profile that reads, "I will never apologize for being a sex freak." And that doesn't look good, does it? In light of the evidence that they're bringing into court. Now, the third day of the trial focused on the forensic evidence of DNA, and the forensic scientist was called David Miller. He was from the West Virginia State Police Forensic Lab. He explained how 42 samples had been tested and confirmed consistent with the charges. So basically, all 42 samples confirmed that the charges that had been brought against this perpetrator were correct. It was consistent with those charges. Now, he went on to say that typically in a homicide case, only 8 swabs would be needed, but obviously there was so much evidence they gathered from that scene, all were brought into court. They also said that they concluded that the seminal evidence found in the diaper suggested before he'd actually raped Emily, he'd been masturbating while changing her diaper. Could you be any more of a predator of the highest level? Now, his defense, and again, if you're not sitting down, guys, just sit down, because you're going to need to when I tell you what his defense were against. Now, I get it. I'm going to say it again. I get it. There isn't a defense here. There's no defense here. They're just clutching at straws, and those straws are very short. Straws that are very hard to clutch, because even with the straw, it's impossible to grab onto them because there's nothing there. But his defense basically argues that because the levels of male DNA found inside Emily's vagina after rape tests were done, so this is after arriving at hospital and after her death, was so low, it made the results inconclusive. Let that sink in. If you were standing up, you will need to sit down now and take a breath. Yeah, so the seminal fluid in her vagina, it was low. So when it came down to the DNA inside, they couldn't quite match it in the way they could consistently match all the other DNA. So they're basically saying, well, those results are inconclusive. So what we're saying is it wasn't our client who raped this child. Now, bear in mind, the reason those results were inconclusive, as in the vaginal results, was because of the amount of blood that that little girl lost. It basically tainted the DNA evidence. So they're arguing there was no way to confirm whether the semen evidence was actually from Benjamin Taylor. So they, and again, just grip onto your seats, clench your teeth, do anything that's going to help you deal with this frustrating fact. They tried to claim that the DNA could have been from someone else. Just think about that. So he's there. He's done horrible and unspeakable things to this kid without a doubt. But apparently, the actual rape, no, that was somebody else. Could have been anybody. Could have been anybody in a locked house where only he was there. That's what the defence are trying to argue. I mean, I appreciate the job of the defence is to create reasonable doubt. And the jury goes, oh, that's a little bit dodgy because, you know, there's a little bit of doubt there, so we should go not guilty. But all this is doing is confirming to anybody who hears the information that he is 100,000 million billion percent culpable, because they're trying to create defences that make no sense and that actually make him look even worse to some degree. Now, even though the defence are claiming it could be from someone else, yeah, it doesn't hit with the forensic analyst. So what they do is they amplify the 10 results at 9 locations. Then they do a second amplification, which shows 3 negative results. But however, in spite of this, when the state did their forensic testing, the forensic analyst concluded that the results were not reliable that the defence brought in, and that Mr. Taylor could not be excluded as a DNA contributor to the vaginal swab sample. Although there was no doubt his DNA was everywhere else, and his semen was in other places, but this idea that somebody else had crept in and done unspeakable things to this child as well, and therefore they were responsible for the rape element, is just insane. Absolutely insane. Also, the defence is saying, well, basically, you can't say that our client is responsible because no one actually saw him commit the crime, as if that's how it works. As if you're not here to watch me do this, it didn't really happen. It's bizarre. But they're talking about that, along with the emotional duress that he's apparently suffered. They also raised the factor that there had been other people present in the home that night. So then they're now suggesting that the injuries leading to her death could have come from someone else. I mean, somebody visited for a brief period. So, hey, wasn't it they who did it? Even though we know the mother put this child to bed safely. So again, makes no sense. I promise you, I could have run a better defense than this by just being silent in court and shaking my head and pointing at the guy. Anyway, they also present a witness who stated seeing another man who they identified as MS around the area of the home, apparently 1 or 2 hours prior to the discovery of Emily. But the girlfriend of MS said, no, he was in bed with me until 5:25 a.m. That's over half an hour after the discovery of the attack. So let's just blame somebody. MS, let's blame MS. MS was in bed. Just like blame him. Was MS stressed? We can throw that in as well. Honestly, just makes no sense whatsoever. Then another witness testified that Amanda had told her that another male neighbour had been inside the home, and she believes the possibility that they could have been in the basement with him any time after 9:30 p.m. But the court agreed this witness's statement was too probative and too speculative to establish a direct link between MS or anyone other than Benjamin Taylor to commit the crime. Now, Benjamin's family and friends, they also testified to defend him. No one knows why. No one knows why. Benjamin's friends and family should rethink their position, particularly his mother, just throwing it out there. But Benjamin Taylor's brother, Zachary Taylor, he said Benjamin was a good influence on his sons. Just a good influence. Was he, Zachary? Was he a good influence on his sons? You mean you let your sons be around your paedophile predator brother and they enjoyed being around him? That makes him a good influence. You know what that could also make him? A groomer. A massive groomer. Big groomer around your kids. He also said there's no possible way he did what he did. He also said there's no possible way he did what he's being accused of doing. Yes, he did. He did, Zachary. And you know what's really sad, Zachary? The fact that you've been groomed too. Because this guy isn't just capable of messing with your own children. He's capable of murdering them. He murdered his partner's child. You're lucky he's locked up. Because believe me, you should start checking in with your kids around what he did when he was around them and whether he was ever alone with them. Believe me, predators are predators all the time. Taylor's father, David Taylor, he told the jury on the Monday in court that he was really proud of Benjamin Taylor as a father to his son. He said, Benjamin Taylor has never been violent, never been aggressive, never been sexually inappropriate. Absolute BS, mate. Honestly. Got the same initials as my father, Donald Taylor. You're a disgrace to the Taylor name. The idea that your son historically has never been the things you've said he hasn't been makes no sense. He's a child rapist and murderer. Of course he's done things in the past. He's got a rap sheet the size of 15 of my arms. The reality is he doesn't stick to rules and regulations. He doesn't care about the law. He violates whatever he wants, including babies. The fact that you didn't know your son, yeah, every parent of every predator always feels that somehow there's been some miscarriage of justice. It couldn't possibly be real that their child is capable of this. Well, he is, he has been, and it's played out in the most horrific of ways. And you not accepting that, well, that's deeply problematic. You want to create a narcissist? Never make them responsible for any of their horrendous actions. Now, the girlfriend of Taylor's brother, She said, he was there for me through my pregnancy. I bet he was. Another baby on the way, eh? Another opportunity in the future. Apparently her boyfriend at the time was dealing with medical issues, but she said that Taylor had been a positive influence in her son's life and had never seen him be violent to another person or overtly sexual. Cut back to the Facebook profile tag. Just a sexual freak that he'll never apologise for being, but hey, nothing to see here. Also, they did note that he did have a few issues. His mother recalled that he'd had 3 episodes in the past due to drug or alcohol use as an adult where he would just lay there. Really? I mean, with respect, that's quite contextual. You know, you're a bit high, you're stoned, you're drunk. You do just want to lie there. You want to lie there until the hangover passes, for example. You want to lie there for as long as you're inebriated, you know, because that's what happens when you get drunk. She also told the jury on the 3rd of October 2016 that she actually got a call from Benjamin. He said, "Mom, I love you," then hung up. Benjamin's mother said she knows her son did not do what he was accused of. Well, just like you had that little silver lining when poor Emily's organs were harvested and given to other children, you thought that was a good thing. We think it's a good thing that we all know your son's guilty as hell. Silver lining's right there. Now, one of Amanda's neighbours came in and gave testimony in court about how she had never, ever heard that little baby girl cry. But the night that she was murdered, she heard her screaming and crying. So again, bang to rights. Doesn't matter what the defence create. Bring in 100 character witnesses. We don't care. Jeffrey Dahmer, he'd have had character witnesses. BTK, he'd have had character witnesses. Everybody knows an idiot, don't they? Everybody has somebody that can be trundled into court and go, they're a very nice person. Well, I mean, he ate the person's face. I'm just saying, if you discount the fact he ate that person's face, he's a very nice person. You get them. Drives you mad, but they exist. Now, when it came down to the judge who presided over this case, she took no prisoners, and rightfully so. So Judge Laura Dyer, she called this case the crime that was one of the most heinous the court had ever encountered. She also, very fortunately, rejected any requests for leniency. She said, Benjamin Taylor has shown no remorse and posed a continued threat to society. On the 19th of March 2019, the Jackson County convicted Benjamin Taylor of all charges. Family members and community members filled the courtroom. A lot of people were wearing pink in Emily's memory. It took the jury just 2 hours in the afternoon to find him guilty on all rape and murder charges. In my head, those 2 hours, they were just given afternoon tea, just in a nice little area, because it all decided weeks before that this was, without a shadow of a doubt, a guilty verdict on every single level. And I like to imagine them just all kind of smirking to themselves with the smugness, knowing this guy's never going to get to see the light of day. 2 of them are thinking, I'm really glad I started that petition online. Hopefully, if it goes through government, we can all drag him out to the public square and be done with it. That didn't happen either. That's just me again, moving into my fantasy zone where these kind of perpetrators get what they absolutely deserve. And the jurors recommended no mercy, which I just love that sentiment of no mercy. That means that he should not at any point get any eligibility for parole. They said that's how much mercy he had for Emily Barringer. That's how much care he had for the life he took. Show him that level of care. Show him that level of mercy. In other words, show him none. That's what Jackson County Prosecutor Katie Franklin said in her closing statement. That's powerful, isn't it? That is powerful. Show him that level of care. Show him that level of mercy. In other words, show him none. I just had to repeat those because they're really powerful. She's a good prosecutor. Now, Benjamin Taylor cried in court as the verdict was read. Oh, boo-hoo, Benjamin. But where's your mum with the silver linings now? Everyone else is smiling, though, so that's a silver lining. Now, this was the first time he literally had shown any emotion in the court trials. even when they were literally showing the most graphic images that you can imagine of that beautiful little girl's body, just no reaction, no emotion whatsoever. Of course, when it came down to his testimony, he just carried on claiming that he wasn't able to remember what happened. He just blacked out. The prosecutor, of course, had described that as a convenient explanation. And he did indeed, when it came down to the sentence, receive a life in prison without the possibility of being eligible for parole. So he was found guilty of first degree murder and given the strongest sentence. And also, that wasn't enough. The judge was like, and just in case things change, you can have an extra 20 years for the death of a child by child abuse and sexual abuse. And even though the death penalty isn't legal in that state, I have no doubt whatsoever if that judge could have passed the death penalty, well, he would be going to that death sentence forthwith. Now, the prosecutor actually held up a photo of Emily during the court case and said, this baby will never get to take her first steps, never say her first words. That future was stolen from her, and it was stolen by the one person who was supposed to protect her that morning. The prosecutor went on to say that Taylor's actions had shown a complete disregard for human life, going on to emphasise just the vulnerability of the victim, noting that Emily had been a helpless infant, unable to cry out, unable to run away, unable to defend herself. They said the defendant robbed this child of everything. He silenced her forever, and now the law must speak on her behalf. Now, in April 2017, they actually made changes to the law, which is now known as Emily's Law. So this basically brings even harsher sentences for anyone causing death to a child through child abuse, and rightly so. There isn't a sentence big enough, strong enough, long enough. It's as simple as that. There isn't a punishment hard enough. I genuinely mean that. Now, you won't be surprised to know that Benjamin Taylor was like, well, I'm not really happy with that result. So he did what so many of these reprehensible monsters do. He filed appeals to the courts. So what Taylor's defense were trying to do is to exploit a procedural error. So his appeal basically focused on procedural issues, so involving suppression of evidence rather than the evidence of his guilt. So this appeal highlighted how they denied his appeal for a change of courtroom. The story was well known in the community. He said it would be difficult for him to have a fair trial. Well, it would be difficult for you to have a fair trial because what you did was grossly unfair and everyone knew you were guilty as hell. I don't think it would have mattered where you had a jury. Everyone's going to hear the information led by the prosecution and you're going down. But the court found that as far as they were concerned, there was no bias and that they did a good job of limiting media coverage. They also said that apparently suppressed information had taken place, the witness statements weren't brought forward, and the fact that other people had been in the home in the same evening. So they said that really that should have been explored more because they could have had an alternative suspect. The court said, listen, those statements are probative and speculative. They actually don't establish any other suspect than who was the actual correct suspect, Benjamin Taylor. And then they also wanted it to be looked at again around the DNA evidence, which was apparently inconclusive. But we already know that the forensic analyst and expert said, no, it was conclusive. It absolutely was conclusive. And there was a whole plethora of other conclusive DNA evidence linking him to the crime. And also, he was the only one there, and he was discovered during the act by the mother of the baby. Now, in August 2023, the Supreme Court issued a decision. I genuinely would just like them to have sent a card saying, fuck you, on it. Sorry, guys, I know swearing is beneath me, but you know what I mean? That's what I genuinely feel should have been sent to this individual. Just a massive, fuck you. You're staying in prison for the rest of your natural. And by the way, when you take your last breath, we've actually managed to get organised with DEVIL himself, and he is coming personally for you. So get ready to burn. Now, when it came down to the appeal, the court found no abuse of discretion in how the pre-trial matters were handled. So they upheld Taylor's conviction and sentence. Like I said, they didn't send him a fuck you. They just did it more professionally and let him know that his appeal would not be heard. Now, when it came down to that gorgeous little girl, Emily, a girl who was so loved, so cared for, so absolutely profoundly important in her family's life, it's left a gaping wound. After she died, Amanda said, she hardly even cried. Just to look at you, those beautiful bright eyes showed me what love is. Even the toughest day would turn around from that beautiful light that shined from you. Emily's funeral was held on October the 16th. The service was private. It was attended by close family and friends. There was a small white casket with pink ribbons. Emily was laid to rest in a dress that she'd worn for her first and only professional photograph, which is devastating. And a photo of her smiling was placed beside the casket. Her obituary described her as a happy, curious baby who loved music, bath time and cuddles. Family members talked about how she'd just learned how to wave goodbye. She had a habit of giggling when her toes were tickled. They said, though her time with us was short, Emily filled every room with light. Her smile, her laugh, her innocence. These are things we will carry with us forever. Her auntie said, she's our angel. I still want to wake up from this nightmare and see her beautiful face and smile again. The neighbours, those lovely neighbours, actually organised a candlelit vigil near Emily's home, and there were pink balloons. That was the colour associated with Emily's baby clothes and toys. They were all released into the sky. The Jackson County Courthouse lawn was literally covered in stuffed animals, in baby blankets, in handwritten notes as well. Just people just coming together in the collective grief for this beautiful little girl. And many people, many who'd never ever met the family, actually stopped to leave flowers or light a candle to just acknowledge the fact that that beautiful little baby meant something to the world. Obviously, by far the most to her family, but nonetheless to the world, because her story has become synonymous with evil and tragedy and brutality. And there's something about remembering the actual victim that brings meaning, because we remember the names of people like Benjamin Taylor, and I want to forget his name, but they just stay in our conscience, don't they? So to basically create an antidote to that, when strangers stop by, light candles, leave toys, remember that beautiful Emily's name instead. I think that that's so unbelievably important, not just to the family, but to the world as a whole, because she's the only person that matters in what I've talked about today. Also, churches open their doors for special services. Obviously, they offer prayers for Emily, but also for Amanda, for the family members who've been left behind in this horrific way. I don't know how Amanda is coping. I don't know. I can't even begin to envisage how you survive that kind of horror. She walked in on it. She saw her beautiful baby girl bleeding. She felt her cold to the touch. And she saw the man that she invited into her home, into her heart, doing those unspeakable things to a child that she adored. How do you survive? And I say that as a question, because ultimately, I don't have the answer. I don't think I could. I'd love to know your feelings in this case. I think every single one of you will appreciate that petition that was put together. I think when we consider these kind of perpetrators in our midst, we don't want them in our midst at all, anywhere on this planet. They are so depraved. They are so deviant. They're so disgusting. They're so disgraceful. They should not be. It is horrific to imagine what that little baby girl endured in her final moments, bleeding out, tortured, terrified, just wanting her mummy who loved her. Rot in hell, Benjamin Taylor. And believe me, you're going to have an eternity of that. Take care, guys. As you know, leave your comments. I read them all, and it's really important for me to do so. I'd love to know your thoughts. When I look at my baby girl here right now, the way I feel towards people like Benjamin Taylor, what I would wish to do to them, it would definitely get me banned off YouTube. And also, I think the online safety bill that's come in would probably have me thrown off as well. But you know what I think. You know how you feel. We all feel the same way. Take care. Look after yourselves and hug your babies just that little bit closer this evening. Hug your babies for Emily. Take care. Be safe.